Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, I'm looking back on the last week, and we've had an interesting week. We had Dan Dresner, who's the author of the book Toddler in Chief. We had former Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill. We had CNN's Jake Tapper to talk about that new movie, The Outpost, yesterday. We had Kim Whaley. Go back to last week. We had Benjamin Wittes from Lawfare, Elena Plott from the New York Times Magazine, our own Tim Miller, Amanda Carpenter talking about what's going on. And today we are joined by Bill Kristol. Good to have you back again, Bill.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
I just look at this and go, you know, this is diversity. There's some diversity in the voices we have on the podcast. So at least there are these islands where you can have a pretty wide range of opinions. There are limits to everything. So,
yeah, you know, I was thinking about that more broadly, and just corresponding with a couple of people by email and on this in the last few days. I feel like there is in an inchoate way a kind of new center, if I can use that term. There are probably much better ones. New kind of liberalism, new kind of conservatism, non-Trumpy, non-nativist on the right, and non-cancel culture on the left. You can see, as you put it, islands of those emerging, whether it's, you know, whatever Barry Weissnecht does now that she's left the New York Times, and Yasha Monk's got his project going, our friends over us at the Bulwark. I think, frankly, we were early on this, and under your leadership and Jonathan Lass, we've tried to, you know, mostly focus obviously on the day-to-day kind of Trump stuff, but tried to, you know, sketch out a little bit of what a new tolerant liberal conservatism or conservative liberalism would be. Andrew Sullivan leaving New York Magazine and getting, I don't know, 60,000 people to sign up to his, what's going to be his website. There's interest. Thomas Chatterton Williams, I was DMing with him actually yesterday over some stuff he's written. I feel like actually for the first time, I've got to say in the Trump years, I'm a little less despairing about the future and what this amounts to politically, or whether it coheres and whether it's a real movement or whether it's a bunch of people saying what they think, which is worth a lot in and of itself, of course, is a huge question going forward. But I've been a little struck by this over the last couple of weeks. Have you been too?
I mean, and more hopeful about whether or not this is going to be a continuing relationship, whether there is a vital center left, center right that will continue after Trump. Because look, these issues don't go away after he leaves. The issue of the cancel culture, I think part of it is, and I'm trying to remember where I said this, but my sense is that one of the revelations that many of us have had is that our differences on policy are not as important as we once thought they were. So you and I might disagree about what the top marginal tax rate might be, but we can, you know, get on with our lives. But we're faced with this much more existential challenge. So for me, I think decency, honesty, empathy are more important than whether or not we agree particularly on the structure of capital gains tax reform or something like that. And so I think that's kind of the basis, that politics is about values rather than specifically about some of these policy differences. And maybe that's the basis for a continuing relationship.
I think that's part of it. I mean, that's a key part, clearly. And about the broad defense of liberal democracy, which we've taken for granted too much at home, and then I think abroad, and then we can quarrel about exactly the best way to do it. I even think on some policy areas, though, you know, you can see, let's say, the tension between religious liberty and gay rights, or, you know, which has been obvious. Yeah. I mean, every intelligent person on both sides of those arguments has seen that they do clash at some point, and we have to, as a society, balance out, in a sense, the two. But I feel like the Supreme Court's kind of showing a way that can be done. That's not going to be wildly disruptive or offensive to a huge majority of Americans. And I sort of feel in some other areas, you know, that even on the economic stuff, you know, we're going to have large parts of a lot of liberals understand some of the case for free markets. It's Friedrich Hayek hasn't been writing in vain for entirely, or didn't write in vain entirely, and people have been reading him. And so there's a kind of, but some conservatives understand better what government can do, and some of the, you can't just count on markets to solve everything. So I do think, there's, it's an interesting.
I know, I agree with you. I think part of it has been that because all of the old lines have sort of been broken, I think, you know, the glass has been broken on ideological purity, and we found out a lot of things were apparently negotiable. So there can be that sort of fresh thinking and more heterodox thinking. Okay, so let's talk about this last week, because often on Fridays, I feel we're sitting here and we forget because there's been so much that's happened and we forget everything that's happened. I actually feel differently about it this week. This week strikes me as a very consequential week. It feels as if things began to come into context, and I'm sort of in no particular order. The fact that the coronavirus is coming back, it is not going to disappear. That we have 4 million cases, we are back to 1,000 deaths a day. I mean, that's a horrific moment. But you have the president of the United States actually backing off from his previous position enough to put on the mask. And then you had his cancellation of the Republican convention, which, let's just start with this. And by the way, before I get into that, I mean, you know, part of it is that because every week is so crucial now that we're about 100 days away from the election, and every week that doesn't change the dynamic is a significant moment. The polls have been disastrous. The polls from the swing states continue to be very ghastly. But let's start with Donald Trump giving up the dream of his Republican convention. That's really remarkable if you understand Donald Trump's psyche and how much he wanted this convention, isn't it?
Yeah, it was striking. I didn't expect him to do it quite this quickly. And, you know, I think it's the right, from his point of view, from the country's point of view, it's the right decision. From his point of view, actually, it's the right decision. It would have been a fiasco. Maybe he's taking a little more advice than he used to in terms of not letting himself be literally a spreader, personal sponsor of a super spreader of the virus in an area where unfortunately it's really going badly. So I don't know if it really means much. He pivots for a day or two and then of course unpivots again, and we've seen that just over the last week. But I think your core point, just on the polls, John, this is a major Jonathan Last theme every week, you know, another week's gone by. I keep expecting him to bottom out and have a little bit of a comeback. It just usually happens that way. If you look at history, especially an incumbent president will have some kind of rally. People get nervous about the challenger. It is striking that I've sort of expected the last 2-3 weeks to see a little bit of that. And boy, you look at the polls, I wouldn't say he's necessarily going down still, but it is pretty stable now at a terrible number for Trump. I think, again, he'll have some kind of bounce off that. But the longer things go, the more people's views settle. I think you just see it all over the reactions to the Republican voters against Trump videos, the degree to which other people are now saying, yeah, you know, that's me too. I don't agree with Biden on a lot. And I might want to vote Republican in the future, but I just can't vote for a second term for this guy. So the one thing I'll say that I did see coming, and you've seen a lot coming from early on, I would say, in terms of Trump's, how the Trump presidency would look. But I always thought the selling the second term would be harder than getting people to sort of approve of what he had done so far, because they don't want to, you know, say their vote was a mistake and they don't like the liberals in all kinds of ways. And as long as the economy was good before the virus, people were saying in a kind of reluctant and mild way, you might say, or a qualified way, that they approved of Trump. And that sort of freaked people out. I always thought the approval number would be higher than the reelect number, if I can put it in those terms, which, you know, political professionals use. And it's one thing to say, you know, he wasn't as bad as I feared. Now, I think now people think he is, but that's because of the virus and the economy and just the failure to improve and the guardrails going away. But 6 months ago, when Joe Walsh and Bill Weld got no traction running against him in the primary, when we couldn't find anyone else to run, and, you know, with impeachment, there were no Republican votes at all for it, one vote in the Senate. I remember, you know, it was a little discouraging, but I do think when people have to say 4 more years of this, even if you don't like the protesters much and you really don't trust the Democrats, and maybe on a couple of issues that you sincerely really, really care about, you're closer to the Republicans, still 4 more years of this, and you look at the photos from Portland and you look at what Trump's saying every day, and I think you just think, you know what, we'll just put up with one term of Joe Biden. So I do think the more that sinks in, the harder it is to change it, obviously.
Well, and also I just think the dramatic difference between 2016 and in 2020 is that he can't be run as the outsider anymore. And I think, you know, Molly Jong Fast actually has a really interesting piece in the Bulwark today about why he can't land a punch anymore. And, you know, 4 years ago, he broke all the rules. There were no limits. He could destroy people's political careers by slapping a nickname on. And none of that stuff is working. you know, 4 years ago, Democrats and the media didn't know what to do with them. They didn't know, you know, how do you deal with somebody who lies all the time, who, you know, acts in this particular way. But, you know, now that Trump's there, he's no longer the outsider who's promising to blow stuff up. He's the guy who's presiding over stuff blowing up. And so it does feel different. And I do think those ads, and I've commented, I think these Republican voters against Trump and the Lincoln Project ads are different. I'll get to those in a moment. But the Republican voters against Trump ads are so powerful because they're not slick, and they really do speak to the people who, you know, made a mistake. And it speaks to the people who are willing to say, all right, you know what, we tried this and it didn't work. And I think that's what gives them their power, because they're relatable. I can imagine people on Facebook looking at that, at those ads and going, yeah, that's me. That's somebody like me.
I think that's, I mean, obviously that was the intent of them, and yeah. Sarah Longwell, and in particular, our colleague deserves a lot of credit. I think it was really her core view from early on that these would be more, this would be the right way to speak to reluctant Trump supporters, to people who might have voted for him in 2016, people who might have voted third party or sat it out. And I think I think it is going well there. I find them moving. I mean, I'm involved in some of the decisions, so I see like a few of them before they get put up. But I mean, 95% of them I just see on, like everyone else, in my case, usually on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see them and these are real people. Some of them voted for Trump, some already didn't, but stayed home. A few voted for Clinton, but now they're really committed to ending the Trump presidency after one term. They have different reasons. Some of them are military vets and they really can't stand his treatment of the military. Others are very concerned about the divisiveness, others just the competence. Some are registered nurses and doctors, and the virus for them obviously is even more important than for everyone else. I mean, it's interesting to see the diversity of views. It's interesting to see some of them say, I just can't vote for, I've just left the Republican Party. They're just enabling Trump. It's horrible. I can't vote for a Republican. Others say the exact opposite. They say, you know, I remain a Republican and I look forward to getting back to being a Republican after Trump. I think one of the good things about them is they capture the diversity of the 5 to 10% of the voters who hopefully, and I think for now, are swinging against Trump. They're not all moved by the same issue. They're not all, some are old, some are young, some are men, some are women. And I think this gives a nice sense of a lot of Americans making up their own minds for somewhat different reasons that we just can't afford 4 more years of this guy.
So before we move on to this future of the Republican Party debate that's broken out even among anti-Trump folks, the decision by the president to cancel the convention really struck me because you know how much that meant to him. You know how much he wanted the balloons, the parades, the music, the speeches, the videos, the cameos from the kids. I mean, you know that this was how obsessed he was with having a full convention, and frankly, how important it was to have this 4-day mega rally. You know, he can't have his regular rallies, but to have this mega rally that showcases Donald Trump, that it would be, you know, as I wrote this morning, the Trump show on crack. So I'm very skeptical about any of these pivots where people say, well, okay, he's now being more presidential, he's now being more sober. No, he's not. He's still Donald Trump. But this is an irreversible decision, and he's now surrendered on something that I think he thought was crucial to getting momentum back and slingshotting his campaign back into the fall. And he had to surrender on it. And for a guy who's not used to surrendering, this is a whoa moment. It really is. And this caps off a truly bad week for him. I mean, we've been talking about, I mean, the two big, you know, stories, there's the substantive story of the coronavirus. You want to talk about the C's. You have the convention, and then you have the fact that we have spent days talking about his cognitive test, because he wanted to talk about the cognitive test. Not a great week for him.
Yeah, no, and I think the convention thing is important because so much of his appeal depended on his kind of showing everyone else up, his just chugging ahead and ignoring criticism. He was strong, his critics were weak. With Tulsa and then now the convention, that seems to have reversed. And there is a kind of snowball effect that can happen where a lot of people who aren't paying close attention to politics, maybe aren't as outraged about certain things as they frankly should be, that they see that and they think, gee, he seems to just be kind of losing his appeal even. And I don't feel, you know, people say I have to go along with him, but I don't really like him anyway. So why do I have to go along with him? You know, so there is a way in which weakness breeds weakness. I mean, Trump is in a, to his, you know, weird way has understood that a lot, which is why he always wants to project strength, never admits a mistake. We all make fun of him for that sometimes, but it's not entirely foolish as a matter. If you're in the business of authoritarian rhetoric and demagoguery and trying to keep supporters on board with a kind of image of you know, tough guy strength, he sort of knows what he's doing. And I agree in this respect, giving up the convention was a big deal. I think about a month ago, Republican Voters Against Trump did a little poll that showed already a majority of people in Jacksonville were very skeptical about it. And I do think also just as a practical matter, he's giving up, you know, he's now raised hopes and then dashed them among people who cared for his convention in North Carolina and Florida. Or maybe a better way of saying it is it's been a kind of demonstration of his impotence and of his, you know, having to backtrack. And in both North Carolina and Florida, two very important states, he won narrowly in 2016. And again, it's the reason. I mean, it's not like he just decided arbitrarily, I want to have it somewhere else. He can't have it there. And why can't he have it there? Because of the virus, because of COVID. And why is COVID resurging in Florida? Because Trump was the one, and DeSantis followed his lead, really, who said, we can reopen, liberate these states. We can reopen. I mean, I think the degree to which that is, it's one thing to mismanage things in March and April to a lot of America, New York City, maybe that's just a unique, weird phenomenon. It was very sad what happened there, but it wouldn't happen here. There was a lot of rationalization you could go through. It's hard to get a handle on these things at first. Fauci got a few things wrong as well. I mean, this is on Trump, I think. And I think the canceling of the convention because of the coronavirus, because of COVID, is such an admission that he mishandled the virus. You know, that's what's the most important aspect of it in a way.
That's why it's the pattern when you think about it. I mean, he's ended up now where Joe Biden was months ago, again, on all of this after, you know, mocking the Democrats for doing it. But again, he's bowing to reality only after all of that bluster and the disruption and the waste. You know, if only he had been warned about it, right? So he ignores all of these warnings. It gets worse and worse and worse. And then finally, he has to acknowledge reality. And that pattern sounds awfully familiar. I mean, in many ways, this is 2020 writ large. This is Trump presidency writ large, ignoring the warnings, pushing ahead, you know, mocking and bullying people until everything falls apart. And there you have it. So one other story this week that almost got lost, but which sticks in my mind in part because the Lincoln Project folks have been pounding away, that very weird moment. And there were some really weird moments this week. I mean, this was a week where I think a lot of people looked at the president and went, are you okay? Really? Are you okay? When the whole question of Ghislaine Maxwell came up sort of out of nowhere, accused, you know, pedophile, accomplice of Jeffrey Epstein, and the president says, I wish her well. And he said it several times. I just wish her well. What a strange moment. And that's been weaponized in that Lincoln Project ad. And I think legitimately so, because for the president of the United States, he's only done this in a couple of cases when he's signaling pardons or something. I don't know that he's doing that with Ghislaine Maxwell, but that was a bizarre, troubling moment, wasn't it?
Bizarre, but very characteristic in a sense. He knows her. It's worth, therefore, Lincoln Project and Republican Voters Against Trump also did ads on this, didn't that good ad on this, reminding people that therefore. There's a reason he said that. It wasn't like, you know, it's just as with Roger Stone, as with Paul Manafort, these are people he's chosen to associate with over the years, A. B, you learn something about them that's, in the case of Stone and Manafort, well, quite bad. In the case of Maxwell, horrifying, you know. And you don't do what a normal human being would do and say, gee, I that's terrible. I had no idea. And I'm not, you know, going to express sympathy for her now. I'm going to express sympathy for her victims. For me, that was the key almost. I mean, he knows her a little, so I wish her well. That could be, I suppose, a little ambiguous that he just hopes, you know, whatever. But it's just
die trial. In jail.
But not a word about the victims. Not a word to say, let me first say, I just want to express sympathy for everyone who was caught up in this horrible, horrible Jeffrey Epstein, you know, web and enterprise. They deserve our first thoughts. I'll just let the criminal justice system move ahead in terms of of Ms. Maxwell, right? That would be what a normal person, I mean, if you don't want to condemn her because she hasn't been tried yet or whatever, that's what a normal person would say and express confidence, I suppose, in the justice system. But the fact that he didn't say a word about the victims, that does show the kind of utter hole in his soul. I mean, there's no empathy. There's no sympathy. We've seen this time and again, ranging from, you know, prisoners of war. Well, so many times, it's not even worth going into, I suppose. But and I do think that had a little bit. Yeah, I think people sort of saw that, and it was, you know, just a reminder of what kind of human being he is.
So let's dive into a debate that's broken out in, including in Never Trump circles, about the future of the Republican Party, if there is a future of the Republican Party. And you had a multi-handed piece in the Bulwark where you talked about the various, you know, possibilities. I think we'd all agree that the party does not snap back to rationality the moment that Donald Trump leaves. The Trumpism has deeply infected the party. So this is going to go on for some time. But more specifically, the question of, what do we do with the senators, the Republican senators? And there are those who are saying that, look, if you're going to, you know, get rid of, if we're going to excise Trumpism from the Republican Party, that means not just Trump. It means his enablers, his supporters, the people that look the other way or even beat the drum for him in the United States Senate. Other people are saying, okay, it's one thing to get rid of Donald Trump, but it's really important for Republicans to keep the Senate as a bulwark against unified Democratic control. So where do you come down on all of that? Because there are people that you and I both know and get along with almost all the time who are on both sides of this question.
Yeah, well, you've written a little bit. David French, I guess, has provoked the very latest wave of this debate with a piece, in effect, making the case for Republican control of the Senate, for not abandoning the party or not even punishing the party excessively, even though he acknowledges that it pretty much deserves to be punished. And look, he makes an intelligent case. People should read it. They should then read you. And I weighed in a little bit on Twitter. My wife, Susan, weighed in and sort of the other side. I think on David's side, one can say this. The fact that Republican senators have behaved very badly and in a way deserve to be punished doesn't end the argument, because you could still say, for the sake of the country going forward, we have to kind of overlook this. It's distasteful to do so, but, you know, in East Europe after 1989, a lot of people overlooked the collaboration and even active collaboration with really horrible regimes, because you have to have the country function, and, you know, and it's sort of the same thing. It's a similar argument, really, here. So I think it's fair to say it's not enough to say, hey, they were cowards, they were enablers, they were justifiers. Having said that, you pay a price when you don't hold people accountable, and and also, how much confidence do you have in them? I think the one place I would really differ with from David is, why does he, I mean, does he really think this set of Republican senators and members of Congress are worthy of confidence, even in terms of their checking Joe Biden in a responsible and serious way, which would be to say, wait a second, this regulatory thing goes too far. Wait a second, let's make sure we protect religious liberty as we're balancing different issues. Wait a second, et cetera, et cetera. You know, some of your judges you're entitled to appoint because, look, you won the presidency, but, you know, this one really would legislate from the bench. I have no confidence that that's what the Republican Party is going to look like. And I think it could just be a bunch of howling banshees screaming and yelling about everything Biden does and demagoguing even reasonable things he does, incidentally, and, you know, without any distinctions. So I think if it really does depend on how much you think these Republican members of Congress have shown their true character and their true lack of not just courage, but judgment over the last 3 or 4 years. I think I would have been where French is, where David is, two or three years ago, honestly. I probably would have been my instinct. By 2018, I wanted them to lose the House, certainly, because I thought it was important that there be a branch that checked Trump. But I'm sort of I'm not speaking for anyone else here. This is my own view. I think we have differences, you know, some differences among ourselves, which is healthy, incidentally. And it shows that I love it when people, can I just interrupt myself to say, I love it when people say, well, look at those never Trumpers. They're arguing with each other. As if that's a bad thing, right? I mean, people do it in a kind of gotcha way. They don't all agree, you know, French says this and Sykes says that. That's good. I mean, this is what it means to be try to take politics and political judgments seriously and understand that not everything is always on one side of the argument. But I basically come down on I don't quite use the rhetoric of, you know, Steve Schmidt and all this about burn it to the ground. And I'm not sure what that means. And I'm not sure. Look, I'd vote for Larry Hogan and for Mike DeWine in Ohio and for Charlie Baker in Massachusetts.
Sure, sure.
If some new candidates show up in 2022, which they might well, running as Republicans, some young vets who are free market oriented and national security oriented and want a new Republican Party, that would be great. Because it is, the final point I'll make, it is in the country's interest, in the nation's interest, to have a healthy center-right party. I mean, so the kind of burn it down thing has a sort of, the challenge to that is, well, what is replacing it and how fast? Now, I'm not against necessarily replacing it. It's just, you got to be a little hesitant about that. So I think it's an interesting and useful debate, honestly, at this point. We're not all going to convince each other, and we'll all vote as we vote and say what we wish over the next 3 or 4 months. We don't enforce orthodoxy in Never Trump land. And we really shouldn't. I think one thing about, like, you and David are having an exchange on Twitter, it's healthy about it. It's respectful. It's serious. It's not without a little bit of jabs, you know, occasionally, and that's fine. But this kind of assumption that, well, I mean, you guys disagree, and that shows there's something wrong. It just shows how bad our political discourse has become.
Well, yeah, and then I think one of the reasons why we are anti-Trump is because we are willing to be, independent thinkers, that we're not going along with the herd. I guess, you know, I do respect David French's position on all of this, but the fact that he tries to make the case for somebody like a Marsha Blackburn, who I think is one of the more reckless members of the Senate. I guess I want to pull the frame back a little bit. It's not just the members of the Senate who are on the ballot. You know, what's going to have to take place on the right is a very aggressive campaign of political hygiene, because it's something has gone terribly wrong. And understanding that Donald Trump, reflects a pre-existing dysfunction, and that Trumpism is more than just who is in the elective offices. I mean, this is going to take a very long time. We're going to have to figure out what happened to the right, how deeply infected with this nativism and this aggressive dishonesty, has the movement become. And that's going to involve the pundits, it's going to involve the media. But this question of, what is the Republican Party going to do? It's going to have to find a way to break with Trumpism in a dramatic way. And I don't know how you do that by reelecting people who played a key role in propping up Trumpism in office, giving them another 6 years. So my friend Matt Lewis has a great column, and he says he's wrestling with this too. And he says, on the one hand, it's fair to say these Republicans have enabled Trump's despicable behavior while doing nothing to mitigate his worst instincts. Rather than rising to the occasion, they instead buckled under pressure. They lacked both courage and the character we should expect from our leaders. If Trump were a more competent authoritarian, their cowardice might have been lethal. But then he comes around to saying we should give them 6 more years, because otherwise Joe Biden might raise the marginal tax rate. Like, whoa, wait. No. If we're either going to have standards and recognize how deadly it is to abandon standards or not. I mean, and that I think is the test. And it's why I can't imagine that I would vote for any of the Republicans that are on the ballot this year. I might in the future, including the ones that you just mentioned.
Yeah. And I think that's well said. And I think a lot of it will be a going forward judgment. I don't think everyone has to echo us. Everyone doesn't have to say we were right. Everyone doesn't have to, abase themselves and say what they did was terrible, though it would be nice. Some recognition of that is important, honestly, as you said, as a matter of sort of political hygiene. But going forward, are they willing to not indulge in Trumpism and Trumpist rhetoric and to justify things that happened under Trump? And so now, a lot will happen, depend on Republicans, whether they're in the majority or the minority, and it looks more likely that they'll be in the minority in both houses. What do they do in January, February, March of 2021? And what does someone like a Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who wasn't particularly Trumpy before Trump appeared, what does he do in terms of with the pressure of Trump liberated, when he's liberated from the pressure of Trump? It will still be a black mark, or at least a dark mark against him, if I can put it that way, or a mark against him, I'll put it, that he went along so much and really did damage to his state by going along. But, going forward, one can imagine him changing his policies and his tune somewhat. So I think a lot you know, a lot of it's up in the air. It's always been my view about post-November 3rd, about conservatism, about the Republican Party. And I think there's a wide spectrum of outcomes. A little hard to predict, actually. How do people react? How much of it is a cult of personality? And when he goes, it all kind of crumbles. How much of it is a cult of personality? And when he, if he loses, the 30 million Americans stick with him. I mean, that's, you know, 50 million Americans or 2/3 of the House of Representatives. I thought one thing I was struck by, I'd be curious what you think of this, because you know the players to some degree, as I do a little bit. What about that assault on Liz Cheney this week?
Well, I wanted to get to
the Republican conference. I mean, that's pretty astounding to me. She has gone along much more than I'm comfortable with Trump. And I've known Liz well for quite a long time. And we've, you know, had a little exchanges about that and whatever. She's in a different position and she's doing her best as she sees it. But then she gets attacked kind of bitterly by not one, but what, four or five Republican members of the House?
No, and they one after another. And then, of course, Donald Trump Jr. weighed in, and then the president himself. And they're suggesting we don't need another Mitt Romney. But, you know, to your point, up until it feels like 5 minutes ago, Liz Cheney was a very loyal Trumpian Republican. She was willing to go along. I mean, she was reliable at press conferences, bashing Joe Biden. She defended the president during the whole impeachment process. She's lined up with him on virtually everything. I saw one analysis that she'd voted with Trump 97% of the time. So this is not about issues. This is not about principle. This is about the fact that she was willing to break with him on a few things, including wearing the mask and whether wearing the mask was manly and what else. She raised questions. She actually took seriously the charges that the Russians had paid a bounty right on American soldiers. And so, I mean, that was enough to get Matt Gaetz to go, you know, you're undermining the commander in chief. But this is kind of a preview of what lies ahead, isn't it?
Very much so.
Kind of look, debates where it's very messy.
She's voting for Trump. I mean, for me, that's a problem because, I mean, how can you really vote for the guy again? It just seems like that's such a failure of judgment that it raises big question marks for me. But leave me aside, she's voting for Trump and she's still attacked by the Trumpists, up to and including the president himself, as you point out. So what does that say about the future? What does it say about how they think about politics? It is a matter of loyalty. It is authoritarianism at that point. I mean, that is not normal American politics, where someone who's behaved like Liz Cheney has to Trump, let's say in the Reagan years when I came to Washington, would have been would be very typical Republican, which is none of them approved of everything Reagan did. Whether they were on the right, they didn't approve of some of the, you know, moves he made to the center and the tax increases he accepted and his apparent belief, which should not be correct, that Gorbachev would be different and so forth. And obviously the moderate Republicans had issues with a lot of what Reagan did. So it was just taken for granted. That's what it means to be an elected representative. That's what it means to have your own views. That's what it means to be a member of Congress. You're not a foot soldier in you know, some authoritarian organization where whatever the leader says goes. I would say I was in the executive branch. So I really was a foot soldier in the sense of the Reagan Revolution. I mean, I had, you know, no standing apart from just being a political appointee in the second term of Reagan. So people like us were supposed to go along, obviously, with whatever. We weren't supposed to criticize the way, you know, a Bob Dole or a Jack Kemp or many others could criticize. Even we didn't have this kind of fanatical devotion and a sense that we couldn't say anything. We wouldn't, I think, criticize, you know, the president to a newspaper because we were political appointees. Though even there, you can find a surprising amount of questions being raised. But we didn't have that attitude that you were a lesser human being if you were a senator who differed with Reagan on this or that, or a lesser Republican or a lesser conservative.
It just wasn't even,
it was sort of out of the question that one would have that attitude. If you go back and look at the Wall Street Journal editorial pages of those years, the National Review, they're quite critical. National Review loved Ronald Reagan. I mean, Buckley personally was close to him. They really had almost created too strong, but they really were entwined with Reagan's career in a way that's unusual for a journal of opinion. And they thought nothing of criticizing him on a whole bunch of issues. That really is the corruption of part of the corruption of conservatism that's so striking.
And you're also seeing this fight between people like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton over the budget, which is also an indication that the civil war over spending is not done. But let me put this aside in the time we have left. The other major thing that happened this week, which again is really quite extraordinary, but also maybe clarifying, is the president decided to go full surge in putting federal agents into Portland, into Seattle, into other cities. He has clearly decided that he wants to be the law and order president. He's running tens of millions of dollars worth of ads. I don't know what the number is about the quote unquote riots and what he's doing. So clearly the surge is part of his campaign. He's doing it with a political agenda, but I guess I'm kind of holding my breath on this because I'm old enough to remember when appeals like this worked, but so far they haven't. So what is your sense? I mean, I've been very nervous about this. We know, kind of warning that, you know, this is an appeal that has worked in the past, and there are those images that are coming out of Portland in conservative media that, frankly, are quite extraordinary. I mean, they are disturbing. This is a mob. This is violent. These are riots. Donald Trump knows how to weaponize that, but it hasn't moved any numbers so far.
Yeah, I guess two things. One is the point you made earlier. He's the incumbent. So they want to be Nixon in 68, to use that analogy, but he's Johnson. I mean, he's Johnson presiding over the Democratic Convention, and you could be a old-fashioned Humphrey Democrat. I think I was at age 15, and dislike the new left protesters and think they were doing things that were egging on the Chicago police and all that. But at the end of the day, no one likes to see these clashes between police, or in this case, DHS, you know, agents and employees, and American citizens. And no one likes to see kids, you know, people getting beaten and stuff. So the incumbent president just pays a price for it. I also think, you have to be, if you're going to take advantage of that, you have to be the person who wants to bring stability, who's trying to accommodate reasonable protests, but then saying, no, I'm sorry, this is too much. Who's really going out of his way to train the law enforcement officers you're sending into difficult situations, mm-hmm. and to make sure they behave properly. And of course, there's been none of that, quite the opposite. So I do think our colleague Sarah Longwell puts it this way, when focus groups, you know, see those images, they have mixed views about the protesters and the DHS agents, but mostly they just think Trump is not handling this properly. He's increasing the divisiveness. Trump is part of the problem, not part of the solution. Now, it could get bad enough, and this was your fear, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago? I mean, it can get bad enough, and it could get violent enough, and it could be one-sided enough in the violence that people would say, you know what, we just need to get tough, and Trump's kind of a jackass, and the DHS agents aren't well-trained, but, you know, any port in a storm. But it doesn't feel that way in most of the country. No. Portland seems to be about as bad as it is, and even there, you know, it's much more than should happen in a major American city, but it's not, you know, it's not 1968. So I think his gambit isn't working politically. And people are genuinely worried, as they should be, about these, you know, the not well-trained sort of law enforcement agents from Border Patrol, not well-trained for this, Border Patrol agents and people from the Bureau of the Prisons and all these people being deployed at the whim of some totally incompetent and out of his depth Secretary of Homeland Security in a department that doesn't have the kind of established norms and restraints, really, that the Defense Department has. Certainly, you saw the reaction within defense after the Lafayette Square incident, and Milley and Esper, you know, in effect apologized and kind of said, we're not doing this again. Justice Department's more problematic, in my view, with Barr, the leadership, but even down in the ranks, you can't imagine FBI agents behaving the way, I don't think, en masse, the way these DHS people are. So it turns out that one of the reform agenda items for 2021 is reforming, or maybe breaking up, honestly, and sending them back to different agencies, the parts of the Department of Homeland Security.
No, I think that's going to be on the agenda. I also think that people are... The Trump, who has always prided himself on having these reptilian instincts about public opinion, is as I've said before, has lost the narrative here, because yes, people are going to react negatively to these riots and the burning and the defacement of the statues, etc. But now what he's doing is he is replicating this overuse of force that we saw in Lafayette Park. And that's what sort of baffles me on all of this, is that does he honestly think that that was a good thing for his presidency? Apparently he has convinced himself, he and Ivanka have convinced himself that this was a success. But Americans, I don't think, are down for right now having anonymous federal agents dressed up in full camo going into the streets of American cities and engaging in this kind of disruption. I mean, that raises a whole different set of issues that I don't think plays to his advantage. All right, so give me your thoughts on this collapse yesterday, rather remarkable collapse of the stimulus package deal. It looked like it was all set to roll out. Steve Mnuchin was out there. There were reports that he and Mark Meadows from the White House had crafted the Republican stimulus plan to spend another $1 trillion. By the middle of the day yesterday, it had fallen apart. So I mean, it would certainly be an indication of the dysfunction and the divisions right now in the Republican Party, in the elected Republican Party, as they're going into the fall. I mean, so give me some sense. I mean, that was pretty humiliating, wasn't it? That was pretty ignominious.
Yeah, we'll see if they can put it back together today or over the weekend, I suppose. Yeah. What struck me, I guess, a couple of things. You know, if again, to go back to my days in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administration, the idea that the White House always has a role to play in these kinds of things. It ultimately has a big role because the president has to sign the bill or not. But the idea that McConnell and the Republican senators, who have been around for quite a while and have views about these things, and McConnell's a good leader in that, in terms of shepherding his own troops, they just couldn't say at some point to the White House, look, this is kind of where we think we need to go on unemployment insurance or whatever, you know, all these different issues, aid to hospitals and aid to for testing, which is so cool, needed, which yeah. The White House was amazingly opposing. The idea that you wouldn't just say at some point, you know, this is what we're going with, and we'll negotiate, and you'll be in the room, and you can make a case for and against this. We've got to deal with Pelosi anyway, so it's not like this bill is going to be the final bill, you know. It's sort of, they're so intimidated by the White House. That's part of it. It's hard enough to get these Republican senators on the same page, but then you need to get a, you know, president who watches Fox and gets the idea that, no, let's do the payroll tax cut, that there's not a single reputable conservative or economist who thinks that's a particularly prudent thing to do at this moment, you know, or important or useful thing to do at this moment. So that's part of it, I think, honestly. And then, yeah, then there are these debates among Republicans, as they've always been. It is kind of important, I think. People have not, you know, senators are not, and members of Congress are not getting unemployment insurance or not getting the supplement that has been available for the last few months. I think when that stops, that's when a recession where you're getting most of your income for now or some of your income for now replaced and your expenses are down because you're not working, you're not traveling. You know, that's sort of tolerable for a while. It can put great pressure. I don't mean to minimize it on people in terms of paying the mortgage and other things, obviously in terms of the kids and education, but you can sort of see your way, you're making your way through it. If those supplements stop for a lot of Americans, then I think the feeling is very different. I think McConnell understands that mostly, and it's why he doesn't want to, you know, simply pull the plug. The other thing was the testing. I'm just obsessed personally with testing.
I know.
I mean, why is it so hard to reopen schools? Why is it so hard to reopen anything? There are no tests. If we could test everyone every day with cheap, reliable tests, not everyone, but a lot of people, if the bus driver for your kid's public school was tested in the morning and was clear for that and got the results in 15 minutes and went about on his bus route, you would feel okay, I think, putting your kid on the bus. You'd feel even better if the kids got tested as they went into school, or at least got a thermometer test, or parents could give a test at home. I mean, it would solve so many problems. It wouldn't be perfect, but it would solve so many problems if testing were cheap, readily available, and had quick turnaround on the results. And that is something we should have been able to do. I mean, this is not, developing a vaccine is a very challenging scientific project, therapeutics, hospitals, emergency rooms, that's all. I wouldn't second guess anyone on that. What we're good at is mass producing things, you know, with massive pharmaceutical companies and massive industrial ability to produce things. And we haven't done it. And that's a total failure of federal leadership and not taking it seriously and throwing it to the states as if, and now look what the situation we're in. And I do think the failure on schools is going to be a big failure, which I think
so too.
Correctly blame Trump for. Don't you
think that's shaping up to be a huge fiasco? And again, this was an issue that he thought was a winner. He thought this was going to be, you know, that suburban moms were going to love him and embrace him. And now people are going, wait, how does this actually work? How are you going to enforce the social distancing? How are we going to run twice as many or three times as many buses? How many classrooms do we need for all of that? And as you point out, in the absence of reliable testing, it's just not going to work. And so this it comes back to it that if Donald Trump wants to be reelected and he wants the economy to come back, he had to effectively deal with the coronavirus by social distancing, by testing, by wearing masks, and he failed to do any of that stuff. So everything like a domino is a failure after those decisions.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. Yeah.
Bill Kristol, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much. Congratulations, by the way, on your Room Raider. You had a 10 out of 10.
Is that right? I didn't even see that. Wow.
Okay. No, you had a good one.
Okay.
I had a good one, but
this is kind of rankling out there in Wisconsin. That you know, a little bit of Room Raider envy here. Is that
wait? I got a 10 out of 10 too.
Oh, good. Okay.
I had a picture, but then I dropped down to 8 when I moved. I went to a different place. So I got to get it back.
You do. Like okay, we'll make that your priority here over the weekend. Anyway, it was a great conversation. Thanks a lot, Charlie.
It was. And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.